Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Art, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Allison Lee, one of the co-hosts of the channel and assistant professor of art history at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Today, I'm excited to be interviewing Christian Kleinbub about his new book, Michelangelo's Inner Anatomies, which was published by Penn State University Press in 2020. Dr. Kleinbub is professor of Italian Renaissance art at The Ohio State University and is also co-director of the New Foundation of Art History. He is the author of the award-winning Vision and the Visionary in Raphael, which was also published by Penn State University Press. His other publications focus on a wide range of subjects, from the visibility of angels, representational conflicts between antiquarianism and Christianity, and the paragone of painting and sculpture. These have appeared in edited volumes and leading journals such as the Art Bulletin, Renaissance Quarterly, and the Burlington Magazine. The book he wrote, which we'll be discussing today, challenges the notion that Michelangelo was merely concerned with the portrayal of superficial anatomy, that is, the parts of the body that can be seen from the outside. Instead, Dr. Kleinbub investigates what he calls Michelangelo's inner anatomical poetics, revealing the artist's beautiful bodies as objects of profound intellectual and spiritual significance. In the process, he illuminates how Renaissance discourses on anatomical organs informed Michelangelo's figures, linking interior experiences to physiological processes associated with sex, love, devotion, and contemplation, among a number of other realms of experience. Drawing upon theological, philosophical, and scientific texts, Dr. Kleinbub shows how Michelangelo created a context-driven practice, which could be adjusted according to the needs of an individual commission or manipulated to embody a variety of meanings. I'm here to tell you it is a captivating book and one that I think has both a really subtle power and a kind of elegant density to it. It surely stands to make an impact on our thinking, even about one of history's greatest artists who I think we believe we know everything about. So I hope you enjoy our conversation. Christian Kleinbub, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So I wondered if we might kind of start just to introduce our audience to you generally, if you could tell us a bit about yourself, where you were born, where you attended graduate school, mentors you may have had, how you became interested in the Italian Renaissance. You're welcome to take this in any direction you want, but we'd like to know a bit more about you.
Where to begin? I grew up in San Diego, California, which may sound like a world away from Raphael and Michelangelo, but it may be that it's the very reason that I am where I am. Early on, I was very aware that I loved history and art, and normally both of them together. And in particular, I was deeply attracted to worlds that were very unlike the one that surrounded me. And a long list of places like ancient Egypt, the Mayans, Ottoman Turkey, medieval Japan carried my fascination in childhood. And of course, like everyone else, I thought at the time, I still pretty much think this, that San Diego is unparalleled in the world in terms of its climate and its scenic beauty. Books and travel taught me that there was more to dream about than what modern California had often papered over. And it isn't news to a native, and it certainly goes down better today than, say, a decade ago. But California, and specifically Southern California, despite its apparent newness, is actually blessed in all things cultural and historical. There's enough sticking through the surface to lead you to other places and things. So I was lucky, too. My parents, who I deeply love, are very interested in art. And they took my brother and I to museums and other cultural institutions constantly. And I must have been very young, I think probably not much older than 4 or 5, when I asked my mother whether or not heaven would look like the beautiful Green Park at the center of San Diego, Balboa Park, which is a colonial revival setting of beautiful historical buildings, pastiche buildings, where most of the best art museums and cultural institutions in San Diego live. My family would go often, and I remember seeing wonderful works like Peter Bruegel, The Elder's Parable of the Sower at the Timken Museum, or the amazing Still Life by Cotton and the Giorgione portrait at the San Diego Museum of Art, and the Indian miniatures that are so famous that are kept there. And later I remember.
I didn't even know that Cotton is there. Oh my, now
it's a great Cotton. I know, such a rarity. San Diego. Oh, it's a huge surprise. Later I got into things like light and space art that was prominent in San Diego and collected there, and the 20th century architecture of the place, Irving Gill's amazing idiomatic 20th century buildings, early 20th century buildings, and of course, Louis Kahn's Salk Institute, which I think is his masterpiece. And, you know, at the time, I wasn't necessarily aware of just how rare and strange these things were, you know, having a Giorgione portrait or a Peter Bruegel the Elder. I think they're like 3 or 4 in the country. These were really wonderful things, and they totally had an impact on my life. And I think I decided very early that I wanted to saturate my entire life with these thrilling things, these things of imagination, because I wanted life to be something enhanced and played out on a more epic plane. I guess most people think that way. They probably take it in different directions than I did. But for me and some close friends, I felt I had the calling to do intellectual things and had a faith that art could have a profound beneficial effect on my life.
Well, I certainly agree with you there. I guess the follow-up question, though there are many, I'd love to hear about, did you stay in California for graduate school? Did you depart? But maybe you can answer that while also kind of moving us towards how you came to write this particular book on Michelangelo. But then, you know, you also wrote on Raphael. How, I'm just fascinated, and I imagine our listeners will be too, how does one decide to take on the biggest, most canonical, most sort of revered artists of this Italian Renaissance period, and come to write a book like Michelangelo's Inner Anatomies? How did you get there?
Kind of by accident.
Okay. All right.
How you do it. That's where you find the courage. I was at Columbia in New York City for my graduate degree, and I worked with David Rosand and David Friedberg there. And I had a lot of trouble finding a dissertation topic, actually. And I was kind of flailing around trying to find something that I thought would be interesting, and interesting enough to really find readers. And I was, I guess you could say, drawn to Raphael because I found in pictures like, say, the Transfiguration, a sort of disharmony of temporalities, insofar as the Transfiguration takes place in gospel time. But in Raphael's representation of it, there's figures who are witnessing it, either directly or indirectly, who aren't actually part of gospel time. They're saints from later on, They may be characters in the Bible who weren't on the mountain to see Christ himself mm-hmm. transfigured. So I wanted to explain how Raphael could bring all those figures together. And mm-hmm. I decided in my dissertation that it was because these kind of outside figures were seeing it in visionary terms. They were seeing it internally or as kind of images inside themselves. And that, weirdly enough, is also what launched this second book on Michelangelo, because as I was writing about Raphael's transfiguration in particular, I was very interested in this one figure in red, this apostle who closed his eyes, points to his heart, and points to Christ above the mountain. And this figure thus shows us how you can see Christ on the mountain, even if you weren't there, because he sees mm-hmm. Christ internally. And when I was researching this figure and trying to make sense of him, I started looking for parallels. And I happened upon Michelangelo's very strange image, the Noli Me Tangere, which, as you know, it's an interesting thing, which, as you know, Michelangelo designs, but Pontormo paints. And
yes, I wonder if you could say more about this, even though we're skipping ahead into the meat of the book itself. But please go ahead.
Yeah, it's strange because, of course, in the gospel, Christ tells Mary when he appears to her resurrected not to touch him. She wants to touch mm-hmm. him because he's just come back from the dead.
Of course. Who doesn't want that hug?
She wants that hug. And all the other images, or most of them in any case, you know, Christ is like, you know, stepping away from her, or, you know, waving his arms at her, like, leave me alone. And in Michelangelo's image, Christ does step away from her, but at the same time, he kind of does what he's just told her not to do, because he reaches out and touches her left breast. And he's indicating the heart underneath that breast. And it just seems like a contradiction. Like, Christ, you just said, don't touch me. And yet here you touch her. And mm-hmm. and I saw it, even as I was writing this dissertation on Raphael, some sort of theological explanation for this weird gesture, mm-hmm. which also carries this whiff of erotic about it, which is kind
for
of
sure.
strange and potentially disturbing.
Yeah, at one point in the book, we're talking about the fourth chapter, and I promise listeners, we'll go back, we'll circle back around, but this was one of my favorites. So you call this, and this struck me so much, the uncannily erotic, this gesture that he makes towards her or pulling away from her. I did wonder if you've gotten any flack for this interpretation. You know, I know even the Renaissance is not my field. It can be staunchly defended in terms of these interpretations. You know, what Panofsky said, messing around with these things is really, really dangerous work. So I'm sure you presented this at conferences or bits of it in lectures, mm-hmm. invited things. And I wonder, have people said, no, Christ is not touching Mary Magdalene? Or, I mean, you even inferred that maybe the touch has already occurred and he's pulling away, which is, you know, it's like, I mean, it really forces you to look at this painting again and to look at the others that you include by Botticelli and Fra Angelico and, you know, think, wow, this is a different representation. So have other Renaissance scholars come at you at all about this, or you've gotten a good amount of agreement?
I think I found, to my surprise, that most people do agree, but there have been people who didn't. I think, you know, the nail in the coffin of this argument is really that if you're up close to the painting, and I'm not the only person who've noticed this, you can actually see the fingers indented in the breast. There's a shadow and the drapery kind of is pressed in. And so I think it's pretty definitive that contact mm-hmm. is being made in this case. But there have been people.
There it is, students. More reasons why you have to look at these artworks in person, as though we don't have to tell them enough. But I agree. There are things like that, the little shadow in the fabric that you just can't see in reproduction.
It's critical, right?
I should tell everyone that this book is so beautifully illustrated. It is a pleasure to behold, aside from the content, just to sort of thumb through and look at these images. And you have sort of done, or the designer did a beautiful job in including what you're talking about on the page, even if it meant you know, showing another detail of an image you already had several pages back, it makes it so, so nice to see the things you're talking about right there when you're reading it. So if there's any reason to get this book, aside from the incredible argument in it, it's for seeing these images in the way that they've been reproduced.
They did a really good job. Penn State is amazing, and I've worked with them now twice, as you mentioned, and I was very happy.
plug for Penn State here on the podcast.
Definitely. Definitely. Eleanor Goodman and her various colleagues do an incredible job.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to ask you, you know, as you're describing, you've already kind of hit on a number of my questions. So one of them was, which of these chapters was conceptualized first? I always have the thing when I read scholars' books where I try to guess which one was actually the sort of seed that led to the others. I think a lot of listeners, especially students who might be listening, maybe you guys don't realize we don't generally write books in order. Or Christian, no. I should say, do you? Do you? Because I didn't write my book in order. It was sort of all over the place, back and forth. And my guess was that the Venus and Cupid chapter three, might have been the first. And this is another we should point out where it wasn't painted by Michelangelo. It was designed by him and then painted by an artist named Jacopo Pontormo. I'm saying it right, am I, Christian? Okay. But this one, I had something about it that I thought, ooh, I wonder if this was the first one. But so it turns out the Noli Me Tangere was the inception point for the whole book.
It was, but you're not far wrong, because the second image I found that, you know, certainly needed to be in the book was that very Venus and Cupid.
Good.
Like it was the first thing to look at when you're writing on the Noli Me Tangere. And, you know, the pointing to her heart, Venus points to her heart in that painting. It's utterly obvious that something internal related to internal anatomy is going on there. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, I mean, it kind of grew out from the middle of the book. The third and fourth chapters were kind of the beginning of it. And then it kind of then wrote all the other chapters in order. It was like four and some parts of three and then one, two, five.
Mm-hmm. That's the way it felt to me as a reader, except that I thought maybe three was first. But you know, if you're listening to this and you're not sort of in the car and have access to searching, you know, do a Google search or whatever search engine you use for this Venus and Cupid painting, which I'll admit I had never seen before. I feel almost bad that it's like it was off my radar. You figure you've seen everything Michelangelo ever painted, ever sculpted, but no, this one. So why didn't he paint this? And maybe this is too personal of a question, but do you too wish Michelangelo had painted this? I mean, Pontormo's not a bad painter, but oh, Michelangelo is such an amazing painter.
It's hard to unthink what's done there. It was because he was too busy, is the short answer to your question. The slightly longer answer to your question, though, is that Michelangelo clearly in this moment, the 1530s, perhaps even earlier, has kind of decided that the work that he does best is the conceptual kind of blueprint of the image. Mm-hmm. And he has come to think of the actual execution of images as kind of beneath him to a certain degree, though he continues to do it occasionally. When prompted by a pope or especially great patron, he will do it. But increasingly kind of becomes a snob about artistic process. And, you know, he writes to some of his family members and he said, I'm not an artist who had ever kept a shop. You know, he sees himself as aristocratic. And in fact, he is from what you could claim barely as the minor nobility of Florence, and it's clear that he used the immense riches he heaped up over the course of his career to kind of reestablish his family in Florence. His nephew, for instance, becomes one of his big heirs eventually. And he's trying to refound his family, which he claims probably erroneously descends from the Counts of Canossa. But that means that he can't get his hands dirty all the time. It's only under duress. He seems to suggest that he's willing to wield a brush or a chisel, even though, as we know, he was carving practically the day he died. But this is part of a mythology of the man. And I think it has a reality to it insofar as everybody wanted something from him. So these paintings get produced. And in many ways, they shouldn't be seen as second tier, despite the fact that he doesn't execute them. Because in the thinking of the time, collaboration was fairly acceptable. And it seems that people often did think that the conception was the critical element, even though there's those contracts that say here and there, like this must be painted by the artist himself, not an assistant. So these paintings are an anomaly, but despite the fact that they're collaborations, they become really famous. And especially the Venus and Cupid, it's one of the most famous images of the 16th century in Italy. It has numerous copies made of it. And even though it's kind of hung high on a wall in the Accademia in Florence and no one really pays any attention to it anymore, they really should. It deserves, and it has gotten more and more scholarly attention in the last decade or so. But it's a major work. And that work, like the Noli Me Tangere, turn out to be really intimate works too, despite their fame and popularity, because they're made for friends or people who become friends. Both of them shouldn't be considered secondary on that level either. They're made for sophisticated people who Michelangelo knows. And he's not doing the same thing he might have done in a public image in them. He's not producing an altarpiece, for instance, for a major cathedral or church space. He addresses the Venus and Cupid to his very good friend Bettini, who, like Michelangelo, is really interested in Tuscan poetry like Dante, Boccaccio, and Petrarch. And it's meant as a sort of homage to their shared interest in Tuscan poetry. And as you know, Michelangelo himself becomes a great poet. I mean, he's considered also a major artist in literature, just as he is in the visual arts. But so this painting is addressed at this sort of group of people who are interested in literature that are close friends and are members of his circle. And so this image, like the Noli Me Tangere, despite its scale, despite the weird nature of the collaboration involved, these are images that probably reveal a lot about Michelangelo personally and the people he got along with.
Well, at one point you discuss in this Venus and Cupid chapter the, I think you call it the painting's fertility, which I mean, it worked in a lot of different ways, but speaks to what you're describing in terms of how this is such a famous painting. It was so influential. It was sort of ripped off in various ways by artists who came after, and has had this kind of fertile presence that we seem to have lost sight of a little bit. So it's nice to hear you kind of say that. Yeah. I want to touch on two things. First of all, since you're beginning to talk about Michelangelo's poetry, which if I imagine most of our listeners know that Michelangelo wrote poetry. I think most of us, when we teach Michelangelo, find a way to at least include the little ditty he wrote about to painting the Sistine Ceiling. Yeah. And, you know, you talk at great sort of fascinating length about this too, and in a way that I had never thought about the inner anatomy of how he's contorting himself and understandings of the brain and different ventricles. But I picked out just a few lines of Michelangelo's poetry, which you mostly focus on in chapter two, though it's dotted in nice places throughout the book. And I thought I might read a few of these lines. I don't know if you have any memorized or that you'd like to pull out as well, but these, I just want our listeners to kind of realize that they should be thinking about Michelangelo in the way you're describing as a writer, in addition to being astoundingly talented as a sculptor and a painter. So I got them pulled up here on my laptop. All right, how about, this one's a little bit long. It's four stanzas or so, but so this is Michelangelo. Oh God, oh God, oh God, how can someone pierce my heart who doesn't seem to touch me? What is this thing, O love, that enters the heart through the eyes and in the small space inside it seems to expand? So, oh man. and there are lots of others like that. You talk about this one line where he describes his heart as being made into an anvil and his breast into a bellows. so that they could both forge sighs with the flame that someone has kindled in him. So, what do I even say about this? How did you become interested in this poetry? I feel like I'm asking a silly question. It's obvious, but do you want to talk at all about what you do with this poetry? Because it really is a fascinating thing. Again, at the heart of the book in chapter two, where you do this work.
Yeah, it was something that I was familiar with all along. My advisor at Columbia, David Rosand, loved these poems and assigned them, for instance. So I was familiar with them already. And once, I was on the trail, on the hunt, and I had noticed the heart gestures in the Noli Me Tangere and the Venus and Cupid, among others, I recalled the poems. And as you just demonstrated, they are riddled with references to inner anatomical subjects. What's kind of strange to the contemporary modern reader of these poems, though, is that he's not using the heart necessarily metaphorically the way we still do in our love poetry. You know, I might say that someone broke my heart in a metaphorical capacity, but of course, you and I don't believe that anything happened in the actual organ. My heart, right? We know it happened in my brain. Right, exactly. I guess one could have a heart attack, right? And, prove me wrong. But, but for people in this period, this sort of we call metaphor of the heart also could be backed up by an anatomical theory. And that was one of the weird things that the poetry led me to understand, was that a lot of people in this period had overlapping and sometimes contradictory ideas about internal anatomy. And a lot of the things we consider mere metaphors were not. And the poetry allowed me to kind of go there. It allowed me to not only illustrate and give evidence for this fact, but to show how pervasive it was. And since Michelangelo was a big poet and talked a lot about poetry, and a lot of his friends were scholars or writers of poetry, it really was the best textual proof, if the images weren't enough, about what he was doing. And so poems definitely became instrumental in this manuscript. And like you say, they appear everywhere in all the chapters, even though I take them up in themselves in chapter two, because they help me show what's going on. And you mentioned the famous scaffold poem of Michelangelo, which is such a weird poem. He is complaining to a friend in this poem about how he's on the scaffold. He's having to stand upright and stick his beard straight upwards vertically in order to see what he's doing with his hand. And the paint is falling into his eyes as he does so. And there's these interesting allusions in the poem to anatomy, and in ways that have never been explained. So for instance, he says somewhat enigmatically that while he's in this contorted position, his memory touches the top of his back. Memoria is the Italian word. And it's like, what does this mean? As the contemporary reader of Michelangelo, it makes absolutely no sense. And in fact, I know that Saslow, who's the great scholar and translator of these poems in English, didn't really know anything more than in Michelangelo's time, the back of the head, back of the brain, was where they thought memories were stored. But what I did with this, and I decided, well, why does he bring this up? This seems like a rather arcane or esoteric bit of an anatomical knowledge to just kind of throw into a poem complaining about painting something. And what I discovered is that Michelangelo is very much aware of all these further implications of the fact that his memory is touching the top of his shoulders. He is referring, as it turns out, to an anatomical theory about the workings of the brain that says that the position of your head affects the quality of your thoughts. Because people in this period, as you read in the book, thought that there were these quasi-corporeal vapors traveling between organs in the body and inside of organs in the body. And they believed the brain had three main chambers, front, middle, and back. And the back was memory, but the middle of the brain was where the intellect and judgment were. And if you're doing something that's important or difficult mentally, you need the spirits to be in that central part of the brain to guide you through that process. And they also say, the anatomists who write about this, that if you throw your head backwards so that the back of your head touches your shoulder blades or your back, that prevents these spirits because of this worm-like door that exists between these two spaces. It prevents those spirits from traveling into the center of the brain. And thus they cut off, this position cuts off intellectual judgment. And so when Michelangelo is painting that ceiling and writing this poem and drawing himself in this difficult position with his head thrown back and looking at the ceiling, he's also referring in the poem to an anatomical explanation for why he's not going to do well. And of course, we know he did well. Michelangelo liked to complain. But he's actually doing something rather learned here. And presumably his interlocutor would have understood this and would have understood that Michelangelo's position physiologically is the wrong one to do something important like painting the Sistine Ceiling.
It's a major discovery. It really is one of many in the book. But I know personally, I won't ever be able to teach that poem again. I mean, undergraduates tend to love when you do Sistine Chapel lecture. I always, you know, make sure that I work that in and show the little sketch or doodle of himself that's included. But now being able, especially in a sort of gen ed, general education classroom, where you've got those who are pre-med students and nursing, you know, to be able to rope them in by explaining, as you just did so beautifully, these different understandings of the parts of the brain and the worm-like chamber that connects them. It's next level, as Michelangelo always is, but I think it moves us, this book and these kinds of arguments you're forming in directions that are exciting for those who come from these other fields and are coming to artistry, I think, hoping to find something for themselves, like understandings of anatomy and the body. And it's just great. I can't recommend it enough. There's one other thing, and you don't make a huge deal of it. I think it actually is in chapter two, but I wondered, you know, since I kind of have you on the line, if I could prod you a bit more. You say briefly that Michelangelo would sometimes use the poetry as an opportunity to change gender. You describe him, I think, as ambidextrous in his desires, which, I love that turn of phrase and want you to say more about that. But you make this kind of subtle claim, couched in much larger stuff, about Michelangelo maybe wanting to keep prying eyes from discerning too much about his private or innermost self, and doing this kind of ambidextrous sliding between genders as a means of keeping that stuff private. So can you say more about that in terms of the poetry? Does he do this frequently? Are there other tactics maybe he uses? Or is gender really the primary one where you see this kind of folding of the innermost self such that it remains private?
Yeah, it's something that maybe you see one or two images where maybe he thinks that gender plays a large role, for instance, in anatomical matters, but it is primarily something we see in the poems. And in the poems, as you know, Michelangelo is often writing about his own love, his feelings for other people. And although we don't know who's addressed in all of them, we know that some of them were, in fact, addressed to men. And Michelangelo seems to have been at least bisexual. Some people think he was fully homosexual. There's some lively debate around that. These categories didn't really exist as we think of them today, of course, at the same time. But Michelangelo seems to have been a little worried that he'd be misunderstood too. He seems to, on a few occasions, to want to reassure people that his love isn't of the romantic kind. So he has this kind of intense love for this handsome young nobleman, Tommaso Cavalieri, who is a man. And he has to reassure him in some of this poetry that he isn't interested in him romantically, that the artist is actually just in love with his beauty and his mind. He's proposing, in a way, platonic love. But you feel the tension in the poetry. And so Michelangelo is often put in this position of protesting too much, you might say. But it's really his later editors who kind of then clean it up. And it's been one of the functions of modern scholarship to try and strip that away again. They've tried to clean up some of the homoerotics of the poems. They've tried to, you know, obscure the fact that very often the love poems aren't addressed to women. But another weird thing, as you alluded to, is that some of these poems addressed to women seem to be romantic, and then that person is transformed into a man. And, you know, this is somewhat harder to explain, but it seems that, you know, he had a very close friendship with Vittoria Colonna, who was this Roman noblewoman, a widow, and a great poet in her own right. And they both shared a mutual interest in religion in particular. And they shared poems and drawings with one another. It's really a touching friendship and at times almost a collaboration. But Michelangelo, in the misogynist thinking of his own times, sometimes seems to address her as if she is a man. And it's kind of like their friendship is too elevated in Michelangelo's mind to just be a man-woman affair. It has to be all male. So you see these weird moments where the occasion warrants gender switching on his part or his interlocutor part. Sometimes he becomes the female in these poems too.
So when you were saying before that scholars have sort of tried to gloss this a bit, and we can understand, especially in different time periods and cultures, why, is it through translation you think that they primarily do it, or is it through actual editing? I mean, I work on Russian and Soviet, so there's a good amount of editing that goes on to avoid homosexuality for sure, but also affairs that artists had. And I'm always interested in how this occurs exactly, because there are a number of ways you can do it.
Right. In this case, at least the early stuff was full-out editing where things were removed or replaced. And it wasn't just, you know, a slight, you know, modification of a word or a gender. There was that too, but there is an actual cleanup process in the 17th century. And happily, the poems in their original form do survive in the Buonarroti family collection, now the Casa Buonarroti in Florence. And so scholars later in the modern period could recover the actual original wording. But it was a whitewash campaign. And and you have the sense that the early 16th century, and this isn't my idea, this is well known in the field, the early 16th century is a lot looser about these things, as was the 15th century. It's really after the Catholic Church begins to take seriously the threat of Protestantism in the middle of the 16th century, that a lot of this stuff tends to be scrutinized more. And it's not just heresy, it's wayward behavior of all kinds. And it's not just the Inquisition, but there's a lot more surveillance, you could say, going on. And Michelangelo's own religious beliefs might have been scrutinized if he had lived longer, in fact, too. He had some sympathy, though he remained a Roman Catholic. He had some sympathy with certain ideas that you can also associate with Luther, as did some of his friends like Vittoria Colonna. And so there's a lot about Michelangelo that by the 17th century didn't look like it was right and proper, that needed to be disguised if his reputation was going to continue. And Michelangelo famously is held up by his first biographers and all subsequent biographers as a very moral individual, a man of great ethics. And, you know, we can't for sure say what he actually was or wasn't. But this became at least the rhetoric surrounding his life. And so when the time comes, it's actually one of his family members who edits the poems. I think it's in the early 17th century or the late 16th century. and cleans them up and publishes them. And so makes Michelangelo accessible as a role model to other artists or as a great person, a great man, as they would have said.
Yeah. I think I'm maybe interested in this kind of the rhetoric surrounding Michelangelo, certainly in the kind of historiography you're describing, where how do artists come to have the reputations, or how do we come to have sometimes the misconceptions, you know, so, someone being constantly described as a great man or a genius. You know, this, these mythologies are strong still in art history, despite our best efforts to dismantle them to some extent. But it leads me to maybe ask you about something that happens in the first chapter, towards the end, I believe, where you talk about a contemporary's description of Michelangelo's body, his build. And I just found this like, oh, this is like the secret stuff. I mean, I don't, Michelangelo maybe is an instance where we do have a sense of him because he's a sculptor and because that's such a physical activity of his physical presence. But I did wonder, are there more descriptions of him like this? I mean, the one that you included made me think of him as someone who was considered sort of handsome and brawny and masculine, you know, in his own time. Later, you talk about the yellow color of his eyes, someone mentioning that, and I was sort of like, whoa, Michelangelo had, you know, these light, unusual colored eyes. So I know it's not the maybe the most rigorous and historical of things, but can you say more about things that you came across? I mean, was he known for his looks in his own time? I think listeners probably are excited by things like this.
He certainly is known for that build, but his face, unfortunately, for him, I suppose, got messed up early on when a rival sculptor punched him in the face and broke his nose. So it was always crooked. Yes. And so Michelangelo was conflicted about his own beauty, or lack thereof. And he clearly felt a little uncomfortable about descriptions, even though he may have produced this kind of self-portrait that you mentioned, describing his own eyes, the yellow leonine eyes. He nonetheless, despite whatever hesitation he might have had, was portrayed dozens of times in his lifetime and afterwards. And he had become, because he lived such a long time, a celebrity who had a certain pull on other artists who were up and coming and wanted to sit at the lap of the master and learn things. So his image came to be circulated, and it's really his image in many ways that is responsible for further promoting the visual arts as a serious discipline, because relatively soon people like princes, kings, popes wanted that image or knew that image, no matter where they were in Europe, in fact. So the image becomes like a surrogate self. And whether he's happy with a lot of them, we really don't know. But people keep attempting to capture them in poems and words. And, you know, you mentioned how well-built and healthy he was. You know, as I mentioned there too, this has an anatomical reason for being. Because in Michelangelo's thought and the thought of a lot of anatomists at the time, if you became, for instance, fat, and maybe you had a softer body than Michelangelo did, that may mean that you're actually disrupting the ideal constitution of the body, which is supposed to be a live, nimble, and efficient mechanism. People who eat too much and put on weight, they, according to the anatomists of the time, are not going to think as clearly. In the thinking of the time, the food that you ingest, there's simply so much of it that it will cloud your brain. Those spirits that move around the brain that I mentioned earlier are going to become heavy and slovenly, like you yourself. And they won't have the speed, the kinetic energy to make you think on your feet. And so, weirdly enough, even these descriptions of Michelangelo clearly refer back to anatomical thought of the period. And Michelangelo, when he's described by people like Condivi or Vasari, they're describing the ideal physical specimen of the artist too. Someone who kind of lives in moderation, doesn't eat too much. They mention his continence too. He doesn't, you know, go out and have sex a lot, which is the thing, according to Vasari, that killed Raphael. Those sorts of anatomical processes actually dissipated your health and your mind too much in the thinking of the time. So Michelangelo, in the construction of this portrait, emerges as the ideal physical specimen, at least on the insides, when you're talking about art.
Yeah, it came across that way to me. And I think certainly related nicely to the overarching topic of the book, the thing that you mentioned so frequently, this idea of Michelangelo's bodily poetics. And maybe we should say the bodily poetics which are at work in his time, which you're talking a lot about in a way that's nice. You know, the two are intersecting. It isn't just that Michelangelo is sort of by himself, you know, coming up with all this on his own. You do a great job in the book of showing how there's a kind of dense web of various kinds of thinking and writing in multiple languages that are intersecting with the formulations he has. So can you say a little bit more about what you mean by this idea of bodily poetics? I think it's on the book jacket too. And it was the one thing I was kind of given pause by when I first read what the book was going to be about. And I certainly understand it better now having read the book, but maybe for listeners, this idea of what was Michelangelo's bodily poetics?
Yeah, the bodily poetics, as I define them, of Michelangelo, is his way of taking different organs and attributing to them different functions or properties. And the reason why it's a poetics and not a science is because there's very little that's scientific about it. And Michelangelo's time, as you read in the book, there are at least four competing ideas about how internal anatomy worked. Philosophers had one, theologians had another, poets had another, medical doctors had another. And often they attributed very different qualities to different organs. I mentioned the brain earlier, and its capacity for judgment and memory and intellect. But some people didn't think the brain was the thinking organ of the body in Michelangelo's time. They thought the heart was, and they were following Aristotle in that. And so what Michelangelo does is he seems to think, when he's referring to the internal anatomy of a body, about the commission and the subject matter. And if he's making the commission, say it's the Venus of Cupid, for a friend who likes Tuscan love poetry, he takes up the imagery of the internal body, like the heart and love, from that poetry. And in other words, that image then refers to that particular nexus of ideas and cultural meanings. When he then turns to a theological topic, like the Nolle Me Tangere, or a philosophical one, he will then take up that discourse instead. And sometimes he'll even creatively cross-pollinate. He'll merge these discourses together, as he does in the Nolle Me Tangere, where the heart is treated as theologians treated it, as the seat of the soul, but he also kind of eroticizes the heart too, following the example of poetry. And so when I use the word an inner anatomical poetics, when I discuss Michelangelo, I'm talking about this way in which he manipulates these different systems. He's not overly concerned about who's right or who's wrong, but he sees them as elements in a language, and he can rearrange them at will to make them metaphorically mean totally new things if he needs them to. Poetry isn't science, and Michelangelo is ultimately more a poet than a scientist.
Well said. Speaking of sort of, you know, context and multiple meanings and overlap in the way that you are. I couldn't help but be struck, and I wonder if you have been, you know, in the wake of the book coming out, by these Nole Me Tangere paintings in terms of their new relevance in our current pandemic situation. Yeah. I mean, they are kind of the perfect sort of hashtag mood paintings, you know, don't touch me, but also in the way that Michelangelo and Pantormos, but, you know, but also touch me, you know, this, I think you talk about they capture something of the experience of having the opportunity to reach out, you know, and the way that Christ reaches out to or is beginning to pull away from Mary Magdalene. Mm-hmm. I encourage our listeners to return if you're not familiar with this very popular subject in the Renaissance period and Michelangelo / Pantormo's treatment of it. It is relevant to our situation. Obviously, you didn't write it when we were in the pandemic, but have you been struck by this or contacted by anyone about how much they're appreciating these paintings in new ways?
No, but I am thrilled by this observation you're making. I think it is really interesting to think about what it means to be denied touch in mm-hmm. this picture and how it must have felt to Mary Magdalene. And, you know, various philosophers have wondered about this part of the gospel. Nancy, for instance, wrote a whole book about it and how, in a way, the fact that she's denied touch actually is a stronger statement about touch than if she had been allowed it. It mm-hmm. causes the imagination to wonder about what can't be touched and be absent. And we are all feeling those very themes right now. It's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We feel the distance.
Absolutely. And maybe we'll feel soon the dysfunction of the heart that they had a sense of in the Renaissance that maybe we've lost touch with, this idea that it's an inspiration, a flashpoint for multiple kinds of feeling and faith in the way that you really get to the heart of, no pun intended, oh, I knew that was coming, by the end of this chapter, that when we are able to return to a space where we can touch each other in the way that this painting is saying, you know, we can't for reasons that are beyond our ability to understand, that we'll be inspired maybe by in the way that Magdalene is in this painting, or she looks to be in this painting, by this really subtle touch that you're able to see, as you said, in person.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I'm looking at the time. Christian, I feel like I've taken up a lot of your time, but I would be remiss if I didn't ask you the kind of traditional final question on the podcast, which is, tell us what you're working on now. What can we look forward to in a couple of years? Is it more Michelangelo? Is it Raphael? What direction are you going?
The jury is still out. My friends like to joke that I should write a third book on Leonardo da Vinci to finish the triumph.
Yes,
but I don't have.
And Donatello too. So
I know.
The students can think the Ninja Turtles are.
I know that would be the fourth book, right? I would love to fulfill those fantasies, but I haven't yet come up with anything to say about either
the
Tardis. Yeah, there's always that. But I may return to Raphael. I have one idea for a book where Raphael would figure very centrally, because in the Renaissance, people like Vasari and others comment that Raphael was this great theorist of art, that he wrote a lot about the theory of painting, except none of this writing exists anymore. It's disappeared, though Vasari says he learned from it. And since it's disappeared, excuse me, and since we have very little to go on, I've been thinking, well, maybe if we went back to the paintings and the drawings and we studied them attentively enough, we might be able to reconstruct a theory of art from those things. And we might be able to say a few things about what Raphael believed painting was about by looking at the pictures. So that's one thing that is percolating in the back of my mind. The other, which is further away from mm-hmm. maybe taking on definitive form, would be something about how the artists of the Renaissance, when they approached particularly thorny subject matter from the Gospels or Scripture or theology, had to often go out on a limb and invent a new iconography or make decisions about the partial account that scripture offers of a scene or event. And the resurrection is a good example of this. It's described nowhere in itself in the Gospels, even as they do describe, as in the Noli Me Tangere incident, what Christ does once he's risen. We never see him coming out of the tomb in the Gospels. But artists are constantly depicting him coming out of the tomb in glory. And in a way, this is a sort of attempt to plug a gap in the scriptural record. They want this scene to exist, despite the fact that we're not told about it. And so I would be curious if there's more to say about that issue, about whether artists, when it comes time for them to become what is more or less theologians themselves, what their process is like, what their doubts and concerns are, and how they take up what is essentially a very serious task.
Wow. Oh, both of those projects sound great. I mean, I was ready to be like, oh, the first one, but no, I think you need to write both of those books. Sorry, Christian.
I know. Give me 15 years.
Yeah, I feel you there. Well, at least we're not, you know, devoid of good ideas. Those just both sound like they would be really, really great contributions.
Thank you.
Well, I have to say that I enjoyed talking to you about your new book today. I hope maybe to talk to you about one of the books that you just described when they come out and come to full fruition in the future. But I really think this one is a wonderful contribution to art history. My name is Allison Lee, and this is New Books in Art, a podcast channel, of course, on the New Books Network. I've been talking to Christian Kleinlub about his new book, Michelangelo's Inner Anatomies, and I do hope that many of you will give it a read. Thanks for listening, everybody.